This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. In the summer of 2002, Kevin Davis sat down in the Cook County Criminal Courts building in Chicago and listened to a woman's dispassionate description of the precise manner in which she killed her baby daughter and disposed of the body. Startled by the horrific story, Davis wondered how anybody could possibly defend this woman, and he spent the next 5 years finding out. He shadowed public defenders in Chicago, and in particular, the Elite Murder Task Force, the public defenders who represent people accused of monstrous crimes with the deck and usually the evidence stacked against them. In his new book, Defending the Damned, he focuses on a formidable public defender named Mary Jane Plasek and the case of Aloysius Oliver, a convicted felon accused of murdering a Chicago police officer. Later on in the program, the political junkie Ken Rudin joins us. If you have questions about Michael Bloomberg as a potential third-party candidate, about Hillary Clinton's turn as Tony Soprano, or other news of the week in electoral politics, send us an email now, talk@npr.org. But first, if you have experience as a public defender or as one of their clients or as one of their courtroom opponents, our number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK, email talk@npr.org. You can also join the conversation on our blog, npr.org/blogofthenation. Kevin Davis joins us from our bureau in Chicago. Nice to have you on the program today.
Thank you very much, Neil.
So tell us, after you got to know some members of that public defender's murder task force, what did they tell you when you asked what I gathered they call the cocktail party question? Why do you defend these terrible people?
You know, the simple answer is everybody deserves a defense, and it's our constitutional right. But I think it goes far beyond that, because these public defenders, every day that they're in court, are really acting as watchdogs in our criminal justice system. A lot of them have a very high sense of competition, compassion. Some of them are do-gooders, but really their motivations are as different as they are. So there's not really one answer to the cocktail party question. So I really spent all that time trying to watch them and let their words and actions in court offer that insight.
Here's a quote from the book. Anybody who chooses this work has to be fearless and unconcerned with whether anyone likes them. It's not a job for those seeking approval. It's a job for those willing to rattle cages, make enemies, and raise hell.
Absolutely. And that's what impressed me most about these public defenders, because every day that they go into court, they are challenging authority. They are cross-examining police officers. They are basically in a very unpopular position. And it takes a lot of guts to do that, and that's what they do every day.
Explain the unpopular position. Put it in the context of the Aloysius Oliver trial, and explain just how difficult it is to overcome that.
Well, Aloysius Oliver was charged with killing Chicago police officer Eric Lee in 2001. And I chose this case because I really believed it symbolized a classic battle between good and evil. Here you had an ex-convict and alleged street thug charged with killing a symbol of law and order, Chicago police officer. Mm-hmm. And interestingly, both Aloysius Oliver and Eric Lee grew up in the same impoverished neighborhood on Chicago's south side, and their lives took really divergent paths. But when you are defending an accused cop killer, that really is the kind of case that brings out a lot of public outrage. Every day in that courtroom during the trial, it was filled with police officers. Every day that Mary Jane Plasek and her co-counsel Ruth Macbeth went into court, they could feel the sting of those eyes looking at them. They could feel just the ill will of the family towards them. They did not walk into that courtroom popular people.
Yet when she thought she might get the case, Mary Jane Plasek said, the challenge is why I want it. It's going to be fun.
Yes, I was really struck by that, and she's not the only one who said that. A lot of public defenders said their job is fun. Now, you know, that's not disrespectful to victims of crimes or their families. They love their profession because they see what they're doing is having a higher calling. They really truly believe that they're defending the Constitution and the laws of our land, and also that they look at this as a game, as a battle, as a joust. You know, every day that they're in court challenging the prosecutors, it's fun for mm-hmm. them, and they do enjoy it.
Yet it was interesting. Mary Jane Plasek, the lawyer you write most about, maintains emotional distance from her clients. And you point out in your book, you went and met with the members of the slain officer's family. She didn't do that.
No,
you know, it's she needs to maintain that emotional distance.
Absolutely. You can't start thinking about the victim or the victim's family and do your job adequately. That's why Mary Jane in particular built this wall around herself. Now, not all public defenders feel the same way that she does, but that is not to say that you can't have compassion for a victim of crime or a victim's family. But when you're in court or when Mary Jane is in court, she has a singularity of purpose, and that's to do the best job for her client that she can possibly do, and she wants to win that case.
Regardless of whether she thinks he did it or not.
Regardless. Now, because I'm a journalist, I was able to connect with the family, and am grateful that they even took the time to talk with me because they knew I was working on a book about the public defenders. But so I didn't have that emotional distance. I'm a sensitive and compassionate person, and I spent some very difficult time talking with the parents of the slain officer and their widow, and saw a side of this case that Mary Jane and her co-counsel did not get to see.
We're talking with Kevin Davis about his new book, Defending the Damned, Inside Chicago's Cook County Public Defender's Office. If you'd like to join us, 800-989-8255, email talk@npr.org, and let's begin with Jonathan. Jonathan's calling us from Aspen, Colorado.
Hi, how are you?
I'm well, thanks.
Yeah, I was a public defender in Chicago for 8 years in the 90s and then subsequently moved out here. And now I run a legal aid agency that primarily serves victims.
And why did you leave Chicago and the public defender's office?
Part of it was just I really prefer to be in the mountains, but part of it was also a manifestation of just ultimate burnout. I said when my burnout would reach four digits, then I would want to move on and do something else.
And what told you it had gone past three digits?
I don't think there was any precise case, but it's certainly challenging work. It's rewarding work, but it certainly wears on you to just see the tragedy of human society over and over again every day.
Did you keep track of your batting average?
No, I think that what we kept on doing is redefining what the batting average was. So it wasn't a matter of how many cases you won or lost, but whether or not your client was treated fairly compared to what the facts were against them.
Which suggests you didn't win very often.
I would say in the public defender's office, my win or loss record probably was less than in private practice, and part of that was the ability to select cases, and also part of it is just the overwhelming caseload the public defenders have.
And now, representing primarily victims, you see the other side?
I think I see both sides. I don't think my perspective has changed. I saw myself as a public defender. Part of what our role was to make sure the system worked, to try to make sure, in fact, I have friends who were officers even when I was a defense attorney who kind of saw that what our role was wasn't to get people off as much as to make sure that they did a good job, and if they did it right, there would be a conviction, and if they did it wrong, the client wouldn't be convicted.
Jonathan, thanks very much. It's interesting.
Sure. Bye-bye.
Appreciate it. And Kevin Davis, it's interesting. You also, at the end of your book, go back and talk to several of the people you talked to during the book who have since decided to leave the Chicago Public Defender's Office as well.
Yes, and those were members of the Murder Task Force. And what happened to some of these lawyers is, just as a caller said, you do get burned out. Particularly in the murder task force, because you are representing potential death penalty cases. And all of them told me that the responsibility, the immense responsibility that they felt when their clients' lives were literally in their hands was often just too much to take day after day, year after year. There was one lawyer in particular, Todd Musburger, who had to defend a client accused of an awful crime. It was a woman, a pregnant, or a woman on her way to a Lamaze class, and she was kidnapped and held in a trunk and murdered.
And Linda Goldstone?
Linda Goldstone. The defendant was named Hernando Williams. It was one of the first cases, death penalty cases, that came back after it was brought back here in Illinois. Todd gave this his all, and his closing argument, which was around the time of the holidays, was just so impassioned and had taken so much out of him that he just felt he gave it his all. And the jury came back in less than an hour and voted to kill Hernando Williams. And Todd Musburger knew at that point that he just could not do that any longer because he felt, as horrific as the crime was that Hernando Williams was convicted of, that he was a human being. And Todd sat next to him. He felt his breath. He felt the blood pulsing through his veins. He knew that this was a real human being. And he may not have been able to be as dispassionate as some of the other public defenders are because he felt a very personal stake in what he was doing. and just left the office after that.
Mm. See if we can get another caller on the line. This is John. John's with us from Portsmouth, New Hampshire.
Hi.
Hi, go ahead, please.
Well, I'm an ex-prosecutor and do defense work today. And I, you know, my comment is that I don't think it's black and white, and I don't think that you can, when you're doing the work that we do, you can't put it in the context of, and it definitely isn't that you have no compassion for a victim, because, well, in a sense, your client's a victim, too. In the big picture, you end up liking most of the people you represent, a great majority of them. They may make bad decisions. They may deserve to go to jail for a time, but they don't necessarily deserve to be judged for life as evil or good, because that's not the context in which human nature survives. That's not real life. But I think the press wants to make it that, and I think our society wants to make it that, because we want to hate the person that did the crime.
Interesting. Going back to the case you write so much about, Kevin Davis, the public defender, Mary Jane Plasek, starts out not liking her client very much and actually coming to change her mind somewhat.
She did, and Aloysius Oliver was not typical in some ways, because he actually had a chance to go to college. He was somebody who did well in school. But and I did interview Oliver later on, and he admitted to me that the pulls of the street and so-called thug life were stronger than the pulls of going to college and getting an education. He was smart. He read he read while he was in jail awaiting his trial. Sophisticated books, all sorts of fiction and nonfiction. And I think what did frustrate Mary Jane about that was, here was a guy who had some brains and made some really bad choices.
Mm-hmm. Sound familiar, John?
It does.
Yeah.
Thank you very much.
Thanks very much for the call. We're going to take more of your calls with Kevin Davis about his book, Defending the Damned. We'll talk more about what these public defenders do and why they do it. 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Email us, talk@npr.org. I'm Neil Conan. This is the Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Ken Rudin, our political junkie, weighs in a bit later. If you have questions about this week in politics and this question swirling around New York Mayor Michael Bloomberg, will he or won't he, email us, talk@npr.org. Right now, Kevin Davis is with us. He spent 5 years following an elite group of public defenders in Chicago's Cook County, trying to find out why they defend some of the worst criminals in the system. What he learned is the subject of his new book, Defending the Damned, inside Chicago's Cook County Public Defender's Office. You can read about the huge odds stacked up against public defenders in an excerpt we've posted online. That's at npr.org/talk. If you have an experience as a public defender or as one of their clients or as one of their opponents, perhaps give us a call, 800-989-8255. Email is talk@npr.org. And you can also read what other listeners have to say at our blog, npr.org/blog of the nation. And Kevin Davis, I have to say, you focus entirely on the city of Chicago in Cook County there, where despite some difficulties, and I know they're having problems right now with budget cutbacks, this is a well-funded, well-paying jobs.
Absolutely. And public defenders who stay on and get 10-plus years experience or become supervisors can make over $100,000 a year. It certainly may not match what some of their colleagues in private practice make. They do start out smaller, but it is a well-paying job.
And that contrasts sharply with the situation in a lot of other counties and states around the country where public defenders are, well, even more overwhelmed than they are in Chicago and make much less money.
Yes, absolutely. Now, they very well may have good salaries, but as you mentioned, there have been cutbacks in the Cook County Public Defender's Office. They just lost 13 lawyers and but also the state's attorney's office has lost prosecutors. Funding of our criminal justice system seems to be on the wane. There was just an article in the National Law Journal that said public defenders' offices across the country are strained beyond capacity. And as far back as 2000, the U.S. Justice Department said public defense in the United States is in a chronic state of crisis. So this is nothing really new, but it seems to be getting worse. And the strain on these public defenders and the caseloads means that clients are not going to be represented adequately. New Orleans was an extreme example. A few months ago, it was so underfunded. There were hundreds of clients in jail who had never seen their attorneys, and a criminal court judge suspended the prosecution of almost 140 defendants, let them out of the jail, said, well, prosecute you later. And these were people charged with felony crimes. So we all have something at stake when it breaks down like that. It's a dangerous precedent to set.
And even in the, again, the elite Chicago system and this elite squad in the elite Chicago system, Mary Jane Plasek, when she was defending Aloysius in this very high-profile case, she had, what, probably 25 other cases she was handling at the same time?
They juggle about 25 murder cases at a time. And, you know, for in potential capital murder cases, that's a lot. I mean, I would guess that a private criminal defense attorney doesn't handle a caseload anywhere near that. The public defenders do not have the same kinds of resources that the prosecutors have, which is investigators and experts and the entire police department behind them. So they are strained, and they don't have the budget to hire as many experts or forensics experts. Mm. So they're still it's not an even playing field all the time. However, though, I would add that in Cook County here, the Murder Task Force, I think, is unique in the country. And these are really highly skilled, experienced lawyers because murder cases, of course, here in Illinois, the death penalty still exists. The stakes are too high to allow a client to have an inadequate defense.
Hmm. Let's see if we can get another listener on the line. And this is Mike. Mike's calling us from Chicago.
Howdy.
Hey.
How you guys doing?
Okay.
You know, I was calling because, you know, the stereotype that run with the people who choose public defenders is often incorrect. I'm a president of a company here in Chicago, and I'm helping out this kid who's had a really rough life. You know, been gangs as a child, abandoned father, and recently was pulled over by Chicago cops and trumped up charges were placed against him. And now he's fighting because he doesn't have the money to hire his own attorney. He's been fighting, and the perception is he's guilty, when in essence, the police officers who arrested him were not the ones that testified in court to say that they witnessed what he did.
Mm-hmm.
And it's kind of bad because now it's his word, you know, ex-gang member, had some charges as a youth. I've been working with him trying to get him to turn around in his life. But yet, because he has a public defender, because it's his word against the police officers, you know, we really don't feel that he's going to get a fair shake in court because of the perception everyone has of him.
Mm-hmm. And that's a running theme throughout your book, Kevin Davis, of public defenders saying we're going to get the judge to believe our client as opposed to police officers. Please.
Right.
Go ahead, Kevin.
They face that all the time. Public defenders are perceived as bureaucrats, as hacks, there to keep the system moving. You know, public defenders aren't apologists for criminals, and they don't condone crime. They're there to serve a vital function, and I do believe that they do challenge the police and do so effectively. And they can. I've seen ferocious cross-examinations of Chicago police detectives that have revealed truths that otherwise would not have come out.
Hmm. Yet we've also heard stories, and not necessarily in Chicago, certainly not in this particular squad, of public defenders found dozing at the defense table and various other, declining to defend their clients vigorously, shall we say.
There's certainly been cases like that,
yeah.
And certainly, and not representative of the profession, and any more than you or I representative of journalists at large. Mm-hmm. Yes, there are problems. There are cops who lie. But there are many more cops who are good cops. There are detectives who take shortcuts, but there are probably more detectives who do their job the right way. I think everybody goes into this with good intentions and tries to do the right thing.
Mm. Well, Mike, we
I'm sorry.
Go ahead. I was just going to say we wish your friend the best of luck.
Yeah, you know, and I, you know, having gone to every one of his court cases and seeing the PDs in their role, I have the utmost respect for them because they are working very hard and they have a lot of cases, and working hard for the people they represent. I admire them greatly. I think they're underpaid.
All right, Mike, thanks very much.
Thank you.
So long. Let's turn now to Leslie. Leslie's with us from Charlotte, North Carolina.
Yes, hello.
Hi.
Hi.
This is something that I don't understand about law enforcement, be it police, the DA, the FBI. They have to understand that they are equally on trial along with the suspect, that their tactics have to be thoroughly investigated, you know, as well as the tactics of the suspect. And that's necessary, you know, for the fundamental decency of this country. I'm a paralegal. I have, you know, dealt with a few police officers that are resentful of this. And I try to explain to them that, you know, you absolutely have to do this if you have a constitution. And they don't seem to realize they're not taught that in school or, you know, in training, I should say.
Mm.
And why this isn't made more clear, I don't understand.
Well, Kevin Davis, was it your perception that cops did get training in that, or that this sense of, hey, we're the good guys overwhelms that?
Well, sure. Overall, that's the perception. And I think the caller's insight is right on the money. You know, both sides are representing the law, and people do tend to forget that. A public defender serves a role just as important as the prosecutor. Now, I interviewed one of Officer Eric Lee's partners who survived the shooting. And I was ready for him to tell me how awful these public defenders are and everything, but he understood her role, Mary Jane's role. He didn't agree with it. He didn't like her. He found her brusque. He didn't like seeing her defending the man accused of killing his partner, but he understood it. And I just had lunch with another police officer recently. He told me the very same thing. He said, yeah, you know, we don't like him, but we get it.
Hmm.
You know, so I think those who do work in the system understand it. I think outsiders have a harder time understanding that. You know, when a public defender goes into court, they really are representing all of us. They serve this watchdog function. They are there to make sure that the prosecutor proves their case beyond a reasonable doubt. They're there to make sure that police don't take confessions from people inappropriately, that their searches and seizures are done by the book. These are the little things that people don't see that happen in court every day, and that's really their role.
They're doing it at the very cutting edge. If mistakes are being made, if injustices are being committed, they're being done against the poor, by definition, the people who can't afford their own lawyer, and that's where it matters most.
Absolutely.
Right.
Yeah. Leslie, thanks very much for the call.
Certainly.
Bye-bye. Bye. Let's see if we can go now to Victoria. Victoria's with us from Sebastopol in California. Hi, Victoria. We're on the air.
Hi. I have a few thoughts. I was getting kind of burned up listening to this.
Sure.
I think it's fantastic and critical that we even still have the Defender's Office, since people are, I think, often charged wrongfully, as we're finding out from the DNA tests, et cetera. And so in a way, I think the resources for the poor are still, you know, woefully inadequate. But I'm horrified by the phone calls you're getting, and even by some of the opinions echoed by the speaker, the author, where he says things like, oh, the person's not a monster. He's, you know, he could hear his veins. He could hear his, he could feel his breath, you know, as the guy was being sentenced. And I feel like, listen, the person is a monster. You weren't there. You weren't the person who received the abuse. You weren't the person who slowly lost her breath as she was sitting in that, lying in the trunk of that car. You're not the family member who has to shut your eyes every night to the horror of what was done to a family member. So I really feel like that people who are not victims or not related to victims have no right to sort of talk about how human the person who committed the crime, and only if it is indeed the person who committed the crime, they have no right to talk about, oh, they shouldn't, their whole life shouldn't be judged by that. I beg your pardon. The whole life of the victim was determined and crippled by whoever perpetrated a terrible crime. And, you know, they have to pay, you know.
Should they pay with their life?
At times. But that's where the criminal justice system comes in.
And if it, you being charged, wouldn't you want somebody saying she's more than just what she did in that 20 minutes, those horrible 20 minutes where she made a terrible mistake?
The pain and grief and suffering will be endless for the victim, endless for their family, and endless for anybody who went through that. Why shouldn't they? I mean, I don't believe in capital punishment anymore because I've unfortunately learned how corrupt the courts and the police are.
Mm-hmm.
So in that regard, the idea that you have all these innocent people we're discovering who were sentenced to death,
right,
for that reason I no longer believe in capital punishment. But if the courts were fair and the police were not corrupt, then I would believe in capital punishment, yes. I want to say something very strongly, and I say this as a person who used to be a middle-class journalist and is now a disabled poor woman, and I've seen how two-sided people can be and how evil people can be and what abuse they can do. What I want to say is that the only people who really knew what Ted Bundy was like were his victims. You know, So when you talk about the DA having feelings for the defendant, and you know, only if the defendant really was the defendant, really was the person, I'm saying to you, look, you weren't there. You didn't see the other face of that person when he was committing that horrible crime.
Victoria, thanks very much for the call. We appreciate it. We're talking with Kevin Davis about defending the damned inside Chicago's Cook County Public Defender's Office. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And getting back to Victoria's point, Kevin, you did talk with the wife of the officer who was killed, Sean Lee, about, and she, there were any number of appeals and various twists to this case that brought her back into the courtroom various times, and the agony that she went through. And you were talking about how even the cops who didn't like it, his partner who didn't like it, understood it. I'm not sure she understood it.
No, she didn't. And this is a woman who was profoundly hurt. She has a daughter with her late husband. And I watched her in court every day because I was there during the trial. And there were times where she had to get up and walk out. I saw sadness in her eyes that I haven't seen in a lot of people. To her, Aloysius Oliver, the man accused of killing her husband, was a monster. And she wanted to see justice done. And we spoke later about this, and Sean told me that she had really been opposed to the death penalty for most of her life. And until this moment, when her husband's life was taken away, she felt that she could support capital punishment. And she wasn't very proud of that. She really struggled, I think, with that idea and didn't feel good about this change in her opinion about capital punishment.
Let's see if we can get Tony on the line. Tony's calling us from Connecticut.
Good afternoon.
Afternoon.
I've got to tell you, I worked both sides of the defense table, both as private counsel and as a special public defender in Connecticut. I had occasion on a couple of times to have a client who had at one point the money to hire private counsel and later was appointed to me as a special public defender. The attitude from your client is often a direct result of exactly how much you cost them.
Huh.
Because you do the exact same quality of work to the best of your ability, put the same quality of effort into defending the individual, and our public defenders quite often hear, boy, next time I get pinched, I hope I got enough money to hire me a real lawyer.
Yeah, it's interesting.
Instead of one of you public fakers.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Kevin Davis, you point out they're obviously unpopular with the cops sometimes, certainly with prosecutors and with victims sometimes, but even their own clients don't like public defenders.
Absolutely, and it's a thankless job, and I think that's what fascinated me so much about these public defenders is how thankless that job can be sometimes. Oftentimes there are cases in which a client has hired a private attorney and has spent all their money, and the case gets kicked over to the public defender's office. So that can be the case.
And the vigor in which somebody like Mary Jane Plasek, who you write about so much, that she can rebound from disappointment after disappointment and savor the few victories she has and move on and giving so much to every client, it's remarkable.
They do savor it. Just back to the point about the public defenders, one of them joked, that if you're unlucky enough to be arrested for murder in Chicago, you better hope that you're poor because you're going to get excellent representation from the murder task force. Mary Jane and her colleagues over in the murder task force, they do rebound every day. They go in there. I was really impressed with how vigorous they do fight for these clients. And these are clients, many of them who are very unlikable, many of them who are guilty of the crimes for which they are charged. In the task force, their main job is to do one thing first, and that's in a potential capital case. That's to save their client's life. That's a victory. That's a win in one sense. If you get a client 60 years instead of the death penalty, you've won something, and you've won something big.
Tony, thanks very much for the call. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
And Kevin Davis, thanks very much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me, Neil.
Kevin Davis's new book is Defending the Damned, Inside Chicago's Cook County Public Defender's Office, and he joined us from our bureau in Chicago. Coming up, New York City's mayor, Michael Bloomberg, fuels a guessing game with an announcement that he is not a candidate for president. Another New Yorker, Hillary Clinton, spoofs The Sopranos and announces her new campaign theme song. And President Bush follows through on another promised veto. The Political Junkie joins us next, 800-989-8255. I'm Neil Conan, and it's Talk of the Nation from NPR News.